Our next presentation is Translators and Willpower FM. I've said in the past our presenter coming up, he doesn't need much of an introduction or an introduction hardly at all, but I will say that he's now a principal engineer with Jeremy Ruck and Associates out of Canton, Illinois. He's also been working in the field for 25 years plus, concentrating on transmitter plant consulting. Jeremy is also a graduate of Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois, and with a degree in Bachelor of Science of Electrical Engineering, and is a regional professional engineer in the state of Illinois with full membership of the Association of Federal Communication Consultant Engineers. I didn't even know that last one existed until now. Please welcome Jeremy Ruck. You bet.
All right, well, good afternoon. It is, once again, an extreme pleasure to be with everybody here. And so many of you out there are, I'd like to call friends, and it is good to see you. I was talking with a couple of the guys over in the exhibits earlier. I kind of realized we're kind of on a six-month plan now, so it's basically April at NAB and then to come up here and see you. So thank you once again for having me back. As always, you guys know how we do this. We always start out with some fun stuff before we get into the meat of it. I took some time off from putting my presentation together, I think. There we go. Decided to go swimming, and this was the sign that greeted me at the pool. Okay. And of course, from the 60s, we had the song about sign, everywhere a sign, blocking out the scenery. Yeah. Well, when I went to see my sister in New York, saw this, which I thought was brilliant. Probably pretty fitting. I actually showed this next one to you guys a couple years ago, and I thought with everything that's been going on in Washington, I'd maybe do a little bit of political stuff. And I think this one's probably kind of appropriate. Let's bring him to the middle so we can run him over. And of course, last year we had the big election, and really, if we had followed our conscience, we would have realized that Obi-Wan was our only hope. Of course, with politics and us being engineers, when you want to relax, what do? Well, have a glass of wine. And when you get done with that glass of wine, don't necessarily drive, but if you do, do it slowly. All right. Well, translators and LPFM, I think, is probably something that's a pretty hotbed of activity right now, and something that a lot of people are focused on. Now, whether you're focused on it as a broadcaster or a community-type person doing the LPFM, there should be something in here for everybody. What I want to do is just sort of go over how the two kind of mesh together, show you how some of all this works, give a little bit of history and that type of thing, and I hope that you'll be able to garner something out of it. So as just kind of an overview here, give you an idea of just the definition of services. We'll review that real quick. The two are sort of similar, but there's some real distinct differences between them. Give you a quick history over how they got started. And we have talked about some of this before, but we haven't really brought the LPFM into it. Technical stuff, can't have a presentation without that. Some of the pitfalls. And as a translator operator, you'll see that there are some pitfalls. And as broadcasters that don't have a translator, or you have LPFMs coming on in your fringe, there are going to be some pitfalls there too. So this will give you some idea of how to address that. And of course, my crystal ball and what we see for the future. And then finally, of course, conclusion and discussion and all that. All right, so service definitions. The translators, of course, and I think we probably know this, but a translator is basically a station, the broadcasting service, operated for the purpose of retransmitting the signals of an AM or an FM without significantly altering it. Okay? Probably got a bunch of hams out there. How many of you guys are part of that fraternity? Yeah, of course. Just think of a repeater, all right? Basically the same type of thing. And this, of course, comes exactly right out of our FCC rule book. Now, within the definition of a translator, we find that they actually come in several different flavors. Okay. Maybe I need to point it that way, huh, Kevin? We have the non-commercial FM translator, all right? A non-commercial FM translator is a translator that, oddly enough, translates a non-commercial station, okay? A commercial FM translator, makes sense, translates a commercial FM station. Now, the licensee of a commercial FM translator may be a non-commercial entity, but if it translates a commercial station, the translator is still considered commercial and still has to pay the regulatory fees. We then have the fill-in translator. And, of course, there's the opposite to that, which is the non-fill-in. And a translator, it's important to remember that a translator cannot be non-commercial and commercial at the same time. Similarly, it cannot be a fill-in and a non-fill-in at the same time, but you get to basically have one of each for the four permutations. And I'll get to the fill-in here. This is also kind of something that sometimes gets lost in the minutiae. A commercial translator is not necessarily a fill-in translator. Most of the time they will be, but what happens when you get a commercial translator that doesn't fill in other words, the contour of the translator is not within its primary station, there can be no connection between the licensees of the two facilities. So in other words, you know, you couldn't have your cousin, sister's brother, or you know, somebody's ex-wife that's a friend of yours hold the licensee. And the reasoning behind this is obvious. You could sort of de facto increase your coverage area by ringing it with translators. And that's what the commission's trying to prevent with that. Okay. All right. The difference with an LPFM is basically they're just a low-power station. Okay. And the difference, of course, between the two is that with an LPFM, you're going to originate programming where you don't with the translator. Many of the rules that are applicable to the full service guys are going to be applicable to the low power. That's our part 73. Conceptually, anybody around in the old Class D days, that's essentially what a low power is now. It's kind of a new modern iteration of the old Class Ds. As I mentioned, LPFMs can generally originate material, whereas translators generally cannot. The only thing a translator can do, you can do some announcements for support of it and things like that, but as far as programming that's not on the main station, that's not going to be permissible. Okay, the history. We talked about this a couple of years ago when the AM translators first came out, but we'll run back over it again here real quick. 1970, the year before I was born, translator service was first created by the commission. In 1990, there was a major revision to the rules, and this was the revision that basically got us to the point where we could have 250 watts, ERP, among other things. A few years later, the governments of the United States and Canada got together and revised the agreement a little bit. This allowed for greater coverage of translators in proximity to the border. 2003, we had the Great Translator Invasion, which we're still dealing with right now, somewhere around 13,000 applications were filed during that window. 2009, which we talked about, I think in 09 or 10, we talked about the AM translators, and that's when that was authorized. Anybody out there got a translator for your AM? You guys had good results with it, haven't you? It's been a huge boon to the industry, yeah. And then 2013, we see that about 3,000 plus applications that were still sitting around from that window 10 years ago were dismissed. And then right now we're in the final cleanup of the window whenever the FCC gets back to working again. Okay, for the LPFM, this got a few more entries on this one. Take it back, 1948 was when the Class D service was first authorized. 1978, 30 years later, the commission starts phasing them out and tried to get the stations to change over to Class A. There are still some Ds floating around. Generally, you'll find them in some of the bigger cities. 1987, I always kind of joke about Illinois being from there, and it seems like anything that's kind of interesting comes out of that state. The LPFM movement kind of started in Illinois, and what happened was there was a group of African Americans in Springfield, the capital, that were being assaulted and beaten by police officers. And one of the guys basically took to the airwaves with a pirate radio station to try and bring draw attention to the plight. So this is sort of where the LPFM stuff got started, was down in Illinois. Another gentleman in Berkeley a few years later sort of carried it on, and he was finally shut down just a few years ago, but ran for many years. 1998, it starts gaining steam, and of course in 1999 was when the commission first proposed the service. It went through several iterations, you got Congress involved and things like that, but by the time we get to 2000, we see that finally the commission has created it. And then 2001, that kind of got cut off there, but that was the first LPFM filing window. So the one that's scheduled to open next week, assuming the FCC runs, goes back into operation, is actually the second window. Okay, technical parameters. The absolute maximum ERP on a translator is 250 watts, period. If you're a fill-in where the contour of the translator resides within the primary, there's no height limitation. Rather, the limitation is the contour of the translator stays within the primary. There's a table in section 74.12.35. If it's not a fill-in, this is going to be like your non-commercial guys or one that's located away from a station. And the idea there is to sort of limit the coverage, and so you're bound by that table if you're a non-fill-in. If you're east of the Mississippi River, you can figure on an average radius of about 4.5 miles. Okay. Zone 1A, which is our Southern California area, that also has about a 4.5 mile radius for the 60. Then all other areas, you're looking at about 8.3 miles. All right. That would be essentially west of the Mississippi. Now, what's different is, if you recall on the classes for our full powers, when we get south of the Ohio, we get back into the Class C areas. There's no difference on the translators. It's basically east and west and SoCal. And those are the three areas. And the height above average terrain for the translators is kind of convoluted. For the full power FMs, we just look at the 8 radials. For the translators, we take 12 radials, and then whichever one has the highest height above average, that's what sets it for the translator. So sometimes when you're setting these up, you want to make sure that you have good placement, that your terrain is not necessarily skewing it one way or the other. And then this one was basically, there are other limits that are imposed when you get in proximity to Mexico and Canada, and these are by international treaty. Okay, the translator service contour is a function of the primary. We're looking at our 1 millivolt or 60 for the non-fill-in guys. If you're an A or any of the flavors of C, it's also going to be a 60. When we get to the B1s, it's the 0.7 or the 57, and of course for the B, it's the 54. The AMs are all considered based on the 60. The other thing about the AMs is it also has to, the contour of the translator has to be contained within both the 2 millivolt daytime contour, which the commission considers kind of the extent of primary service, and also a 25 mile radius. And that kind of makes sense. You know, kind of a hyperbolic example would be, I could put a translator, if they'd not had that 25 mile radius, I could put a translator in Champaign, Illinois, rebroadcasting WLS, okay? So the idea was to keep it for the primary coverage areas of the AMs and to help those areas out. Excuse me. For the LPFM technical parameters, we have the LP10s, which has a maximum ERP at 10 watts at 30 meters, or about 100 feet. And those also give you a maximum height above average terrain of 100 meters, and there you'd have 1 watt ERP. And then there's always a minimum ERP of 1 watt at any height, can't go below that. But there's no minimum contour distance for the LP10. So the idea originally behind this was for some of the urban areas to do it on a very small neighborhood. The LP100s, which is actually the only one that's in place right now, the LP10s were deleted, is a maximum ERP of 100 watts at 30 meters. And these guys also have a maximum height of 450 with 1 watt. Obviously, we're not going to probably see too much of that around here. That would be more in the mountainous areas. These do have a minimum contour distance, though, 4.7 kilometers, which works out to about 3 miles. And then it got cut off here, but the maximum distance is 5.6 kilometers. So there's kind of a narrow window in which the LP100s are to operate. Okay, there was a proposal to do the LP250s, which was a 250 watt station. That the commission has not implemented those at this time, but they have left that open to potentially some future consideration down the road. But there will not be any 250s in the upcoming window. And as I mentioned, the LP10 class has been deleted. It was deleted because actually nobody ever filed for them. Even though they allowed for it in 2001, there were no applications filed for LP10s. So only right now we only have the 100s authorized, and that'll be it. Okay, signal delivery kind of makes sense if they're kind of a mini version of a full power, that they're going to originate programming of some kind. Okay. Translators, of course, generally do not. The off-air feed of the translator is basically that, just pick it up off the air. Now, there are some restrictions on that and some limitations, which we'll get to here in just a minute. Terrestrial feed of translators, this can be done by anything like a BrickLink, DSL, microwave, anything of that ilk. But if you're doing it that way, it has to be a fill-in translator, okay? So keep that in mind. If you perhaps are a non-com and you have a translator non-com, you can do it. But as a commercial, you can use any type of method to feed the translator. The non-com guys do have the satellite available, and that would be a translator in the reserve, the non-commercial part of the band, repeating a non-commercial signal. And that's where you get some of your stations, maybe California, or I think there's one in Alabama that does that, where they have a lot of stations around the country. Now, an LPFM can feed a translator, and an LPFM licensee can also own a translator. Now, remember that the LPFMs, by definition, are non-commercial. So there isn't that prohibition on extending the coverage contour with them. The prohibitions on the translator feed methods, that's just basically if you're not a fill-in, you don't get to use the terrestrial stuff. Okay, protections are also sort of run on a first-come, first-serve thing. So if I file my application before you file yours, mine's going to take precedence, unless we're in a window. Remember, the translator is a secondary authorization. All right, there's no city license coverage requirement with a translator, but at the same time, it's also subject to being forced off the air by FMs or TVs if an interference situation is created. And that sometimes does run into problems, and I've got an example here in a little bit to show you about that. The LPFM guys, one of the things that did stick with the rules is that they do have to protect third adjacent translator inputs. Okay. And essentially with a translator, there's no outgoing interference permitted. With an LPFM, though, there is some limited interference that's allowed. Okay. So there's a very distinct difference between those two. If a translator is causing you some problems, you do have a hammer to force them off. But in LPFM, that's not necessarily going to be the case. And as always, complaints are the driving force of interference. It's not based necessarily on area. It's based on the population and how many people scream the loudest about the particular issue. Okay, so here's our allocation. How do we allocate these? Well, the LPFMs kind of follow a similar type of situation as a full-power FMs and use a spacing table. There are no spacing requirements for translators in general. The IF spacing is sort of debatable. One of the staff members of the FCC told me that he is not able in the program that they use to see the IF spacings, which basically requires you to keep it below 100 watts. But his suggestion was, if you're filing something in the window, make it comply with that and then try and come back later. Okay. So the only potential spacing that we would have as a translator is that IF. Generally, they're going to follow a contour protection type of model, similar to the non-commercials. And then with the LPFM, there is a waiver of the second adjacent channel protection that you can get, and I'll show you how that works. For the translators, there really isn't a waiver that's necessary. Section 741204D basically gives an out, and what it says is that if you have an application that violates contour protection, the commission may still accept it if you can prove that there's no interference that's going to be caused. And some of the guys have come up with, we've come up with some different tricks to do that, and I'll show you the one that I use. And then the third adjacent does apply to the translators, whereas Congress and the Commission deleted that requirement for the LPFM except for that translator input. And I have no idea what this one, I think it's limited circumstances. Okay, spectrum competition. All right, we've all seen the results of the past few filing windows. They're pretty much akin to a dam bursting. The commission does this thing of holding up the demand, and then they're surprised about it when they open up a filing window and get thousands of applications. And quite simply, in 2003, they underestimated the demand that was going to happen. They did not expect spectrum warehousing. Okay, we know about the various guys of the Radio Training Network and some of them that literally filed thousands of applications. And of that 3,000 applications that were dismissed this year, there were about, I think, three or four applicants that had about 75 or 80% of those applications still outstanding. Okay, what these guys were doing was just obviously hedging their bets. Commission's going to clamp down on that, obviously, but, you know, it was too late. It was one of those, you know, exploit the loophole in the rule. Auction 83 produced that conundrum then. Okay, how do we deal with all the spectrum requirements? We've got the LPFM sitting out here that we need to do something with, and we've got 13,000 applications. And so typical on a lot of stuff is we just, oh, we're going to stop it for right now, and we'll get back to that later. As a result, we had thousands of applications frozen for a decade. Okay. Now, the applications that were originally filed were done what we call a short form. So it was just a proposal. So there was no mechanism on the interim years for doing any kind of a cleanup. And that's part of the reason that they sat there. I had one particular client that had about 60 of them sitting there. And on about a half a dozen of them, I had figured out ways very easily to extricate them from the MX situation. But because it was a short form, there was nothing we could do about it until the commission decided to move forward. And part of what triggered a lot of this is a mandate from Congress, once again, them, you know, dictating something be done. And they mandated that there has to be spectrum available for full power, for translators, and for LPFM. And so with the applications, the commission had to figure out a mechanism as to how to get rid of that and accommodate everybody. So many of these applications that were pending did require dismissal. There was a market cap and a national cap that was imposed. If you had more than 50 applications, you were required to dismiss everything to get you down to 50. Now, you could pick whatever you wanted to dismiss, but you still had to get down to that. The market caps were based on the top 150 markets, and you were allowed one in those markets. One of my clients had three of them in the Memphis market, and so we had to play the chess game and figure out which would be the best one to keep and dismiss the rest of them. As part of this, the commission established the LPFM grid concept. And the LPFM grid basically replaced what they'd originally talked about doing, which was process all or dismiss all. And that was based on the market size. And they looked at the number of non-commercial stations and based on the market size decided how many LPFMs needed to be in a particular market and came up with this mechanism for doing that. It was the top 150 radio markets that were studied plus a few other ones where there was a high level of congestion. And what they did was they established a 30 by 30 or a 20 by 20 minute and a latitude longitude minute grid centered on the population area of the market. They started out with a 30 by 30 grid, and if they found that it was what was called spectrum limited, where there were fewer available channels than that floor, then they would compress the grid down to 20 by 20 minutes and see what happened with the population and things like that. So any market that we consider what we call a spectrum limited is at the 30 by 30, and the available markets where there are plenty more channels available could be at a 30 or a 20 minute resolution. There's that classification, of course. And as part of this, any pending translator application that was out there could not impact the grid. And the commission went through and identified specific points within each of these grids as identifiable LPFM opportunities. And so anything that was still pending could not impact any of those, even though that's kind of a, you know, an ex post facto thing that it was done after everybody filed. Okay, grids. Here's an example of the Chicago market grid. And Chicago is obviously would be a spectrum limited market because of the amount of stations there. Remember, one of the things about Chicago has a lot of Class B stations in it, which do not meet the current spacing. So there are more stations jammed into that market than what you could potentially jam into the market nowadays with the current rules. And around the grid, the commission established what's called the grid buffer, and that's that blue construct. Basically what that is, that's a 39-kilometer radius from the perimeter of the grid. And a 39-kilometer comes out of the spacing table with the LPFMs. That's the maximum co-channel spacing that they have to protect. So if you had a pending application that was outside that buffer, it was obvious you weren't going to impact the grid at all, and so you didn't have to do anything about it. If you were within that buffer or within the grid, then you had to prove to the commission that you weren't going to affect the LPFM opportunities. Here's an example of a study I did for a client. This is down in Texas. And this one, I believe, was, well, it doesn't really matter. But the point being, you can see down there were multiple grids around here. We have the Shreveport grid somewhere. There it is. Had a Shreveport grid here. I think this was the Houston one, and then we had, this was Tyler Longview over here, okay? And so my guy was out here in the middle, and so obviously he was well away from any of the grids, so we didn't have to show any extra protection there. Now, this was another one that was done, and this is actually in the Tyler area. And in this particular case, our site that we had was up here to the northeast side, right here, okay? So he's inside the buffer, but he's outside the grid. And so what we did here was we showed that these were full power FMs, and so on this particular channel, it didn't impact the grid because use of the grid was already precluded by other facilities, okay? Here's a different one, and this one was for Tulsa. And in this particular case, our site was down here that we proposed, which was in the grid, okay? But once again, because there were lots of full service facilities in the area, it soaked up those channels that were possible, and therefore, even though we were putting a translator in there, there was no impact to the LPFM licensing in the grid. Okay? And then this is one that we actually ended up constructing and putting on the air here just a few weeks ago. And this is down in Memphis. And this shows you here is the original site that we had proposed was over here. And then the actual site wound up being down here. And Memphis is what was considered a spectrum available market. So we had to look at everything on the channel of operation and two channels either side of it. So in this particular group of channels, I believe this was like two or three of them, and I sort of lumped it in one exhibit, you could see that the grid was already precluded. But on one of the other channels that we had to consider, that was not the case, okay? And so what we have down here is where our translator site is, and on this particular channel, here's our spacing radius, and then these were all the points that the commission identified as being potential LPFM opportunities within the grid. And of course, in this particular channel, we did not hit any of those. And so we didn't impact anything that would potentially be dropped in on that channel within the grid. And then there was one more we had to consider. And I kind of got lazy on this one because it was late at night when I was working on it. And I didn't want to enter in all these points, so I just kind of took the cheap way and put a point on each end and drew a segment between it. But on this particular channel, you can see there were areas up here and then over here. And if you kind of look at these, you can see they kind of follow a circular pattern. So what they are is they're just a spacing radius. And once again, where the translator took out areas of the grid, it wasn't usable anyway. Okay. As I mentioned, the initial basis for the allocation for dropping a translator in is going to be contour-based. That's where I start when I do these things. And they follow the usual ratios. It's the protected contour of the FM that you're considering, of course, is based on its class, whether it's an A or C or one of the flavors of the Bs. So for the co-channel, it's a minus 20, undesired to desired. That's like 40 to 60. For a first adjacent, it's a minus 6 ratio. And then, of course, when we get to the second and third, it's a plus 20. All right, so it flips over and it goes the other, or I'm sorry, plus 40. So it goes the other way. As I mentioned on 1204D, the commission allows us to use alternate methods to study this. Okay. Alternate methods usually, remember what I said there, the alternate methods work for the second and the third adjacents. You're going to have a lot of trouble getting those to work on a first or a co unless you've got some real terrain obstructions. All right, so here's an example of sort of where we start, and I think this one was, this was one that I did down in Effingham, Illinois. And you can see just kind of a run-of-the-mill general contour overlap study. And what's important to note on this one is that here, this is one of the guy that we're going to do the alternate study to. This is his protected contour, and here's our translator, so it lies within it. So we know that there's overlap, obviously, there, but it's clean everywhere else. So for this guy here, we're going to have to do our alternate study. Here's the actual quote for 1204D. So I'll leave that up there for a sec and keep moving on. So this allows for alternate methods to be used, as I mentioned. Terrain's generally not going to be applicable in the Midwest. Okay. Now, Colorado, places like that, sure, you can probably use that. Now, although it's very, very accurate, Lonely Rice is going to have to be, if you use that, we have to supplant that with augment it with another type of study. Some of the guys that process the applications at the commission just do not like Lonely Rice. One of the big things with Lonely Rice is you can skew it a lot of different ways to give you different numbers. You can play with ground cover attenuation, you can play with receiving heights, things like that. So you can kind of make anything look like anything to a certain extent with Lonely Rice. And I think that's one of the reasons that they're not in favor of it. They like to stay with the contours, which are hard and dry. Just a simple ratio study works very, very well for second and third adjacent situations. And the idea here, once again, is to show that wherever that interference occurs, that there's zero population. Okay. Now remember that your antenna radiation varies in a vertical plane. It's also going to vary in horizontal. Anybody got an omnidirectional antenna out there? And I'll raise your hands. No such thing as an omnidirectional antenna. Okay. So no matter what we do, where we mount an antenna, there's always going to be some sort of characteristic. Now we don't usually have to worry about that with the translators, but as a function of the antenna, it's not going to radiate uniformly in all directions. So we exploit that in doing these kind of studies. Now when you're doing a second or third adjacent, and this seems a little bit counterintuitive, but that's a function of that plus ratio, it works better the closer you are to the station that you're trying to protect. Okay. The ideal situation is co-location. If you think about it, if you've got a 250-watt translator, you're going to put on a tower with a 25-kilowatt class B1, there's never any situation where that translator is going to be more than 40 dB above the full power. Now, where it falls apart is when you start putting the translator or the LPFM, because you can do the same thing with the LPs, is when they're very, very close to the protected contour, all right? Because we start looking at that 100 dBU to 60, and that now becomes a big enough distance that it's hard to avoid population unless you can get some pretty good altitude for it. And the basis of this, the method I use is a free space calculation. Okay, and the free space, remember too, and that was the line that got chopped off on there, is that the electric field strength, your dBU, we can relate that to power density through the free space impedance. And then, of course, power density, we can figure out what that quantity is at a radius, and so we solve for the radius. This is basically an Excel spreadsheet I wrote to do this. Once again, you know, being lazy is kind of the mother of all invention. And what I found was when I was going through lots and lots of these applications, I kept having to enter in, you know, mass amounts of data. It's like, oh, well, that pattern doesn't work. I'll go back to something else. So I got the idea of basically building a huge lookup table in Excel with, you know, 8 million patterns in it. Then I can just cycle through real quickly. And so what it does, what I did with it here basically is here's your tabulation based on your depression angle. Here's the vertical pattern of the antenna. And we enter in the field strength that we want, and then here's where the interference area lies relative to ground. And this is just kind of a zoomed-in version of this graph, and I just added some other stuff to make it look cool. But, you know, hey, I'm a geek, come on, you know. So, but what's important is what this shows here is that where this interference area comes down or makes the closest approach to ground is 25 meters. So we're looking at an interference area that's, you know, upwards of 100 feet above ground. And when you look at, I guess I did write it out here, 20.4 meters, and the horizontal distance out was 75 meters or 245 feet. So here's actually a satellite shot from Google Earth of that particular tower site. And this is that 74.6 horizontal radius, and you can see there ain't anything in there, okay? So the likelihood of hitting anybody would be pretty slim unless, you know, we're flying on pigs or just sort of hanging out in the ether or maybe, you know, skydiving through there. So this was one of those that, yeah, you know, there's absolutely no problem with it. Local terrain is something that does need to be considered. In this particular case, it was eastern Illinois, which is flat. You know, it rains over there. It's like a cow peeing on a flat rock. It just, you know, runs everywhere. But when we get into some of the areas, Wisconsin, where we have more undulations in the terrain, we need to look at that, because what you might find is perhaps you think you've got an interference problem, but a house is lower down or something like that. And so the elevation may vary as you approach your structures. This was an example of one that I did over in Rochester for a client. And in this particular case, it was done during the cleanup window, so we had to look at both directions of the situation. And this was the opposing guy, and I'm not sure, I think he has coordinates wrong, but you know, whatever, it's what was on file. So what we calculated up is the interference area was this, obviously you can see it there, this red circle, okay? So we think, okay, yeah, we're kind of getting close to these houses and getting close to this neighborhood. But when we turned it and panned it, we can see that the terrain sloped down quite a bit. And so that interference region actually wound up being above the houses and not hitting anything. And this, I mean, this required about, you know, 4 pages of explanation that, but, you know, they bought it. And here's a shot of that neighborhood. You can see also the other argument I made was that even though it may approach some of these structures, given the type of construction, it isn't going to impact the houses, okay? All right, we've talked about this before in previous things. An absence of contour overlap or an absence of interference, it does not necessarily follow from a lack of contour overlap. And the converse is also true, too. Just because you've got contour overlap doesn't mean you have interference. Contour proximity, if you're looking at picking up a translator that's out there, contour proximity, especially on co and first adjacent situations, can be a huge pitfall. Huge pitfall. And there's what I call grantability versus survivability. Grantability is what we can get through the commission. Survivability is what you can run long term without somebody complaining about it. Okay. This is an example of one I took a look at that I found. This is, for some reason, I'm gravitating towards Memphis today. This was another Memphis one, and this particular construction permit for the translator was on the block. And it had a co-channel up here in Tennessee and a co-channel down here in Arkansas. And so we have the 40 and the 60s here. We can see that, okay, these guys that engineered this, they didn't get any contour overlap down here, and there's no contour overlap up here. And the 40s coming off the FMs are coming into Memphis. So we think, yeah, okay, maybe it's all right. Well, what we did was we dug into it a little bit deeper and looked at what is the interference in terms of Longley Rice as a real world. Now, the Longley Rice was not admissible to the commission, but this was just basically, you know, sort of as an advisement to my client. And what we did, what I did here was I left everything, I color-coded the interference, and the blue was the interference to this guy down here that would come off of that translator. And you can see there's a pretty substantial amount of it, all right? So that gave me some caution, but as we dug a little deeper, what you found is a lot of that was already masked by other stations. And in fact, the red is the interference coming from this guy way up here in Tennessee. So this was one of these you got to beware type of thing when they're asking for, you know, $750,000, $1 million for a construction permit for something that's an unproven signal. And a lot of, I think a lot of the licensees out there have understood this, and they're more hesitant to buy a, you know, an unproven signal. Okay, my crystal ball, LPFM demand, we think, during the upcoming window, which is supposed to open 6 days from now, probably isn't, expect it to be pretty robust. Initially, I wasn't so sure it was going to be, but it sounds like it is going to be pretty robust. Here's the bad news. If you are a full power guy, you're going to have to expect that you're probably going to get some interference, okay? Especially in some of the more congested areas. There aren't going to be too many avenues for mitigation. Some of us, you're just going to have to deal with it, unfortunately. And the only hammer that you have against the LPFMs is if the interference is occurring within your community of license, okay? In that particular case, then the commission allows you to get them to move and things like that. But if it's, you know, on the fringe of your 60 or something like that, sorry about that. There's just there's nothing you can do. There is another translator window possible. Acting Chairwoman Clyburn kind of hinted at that. She's talking about possibly doing another window for AM licensees. So if any of you are AMs, get ready for that. Start thinking about it. I would not have anybody look at that until after the LPFM window closes because, you know, the database is going to be a disaster after that. It's going to be limited AM, as I mentioned. And I think the benefit on this is going to be more in the rural areas. We know places like, you know, Chicago, St. Louis, Milwaukee, the spectrum is going to be soaked up. What remaining spectrum is there is going to be soaked up by the LPFMs. Similarly, some of the mid-markets, Peoria, Madison, places like that, there may be some opportunities, but I think some of those are going to dry up. Places like Kansas, Nebraska, where plenty of open channels and small population density, these are the areas I think where we'll get the most benefit from this upcoming window. And I got no idea what that one was, so we won't talk about it. And that should be it, actually, I believe. Get the cool effect here. There it is. All right, cool. Well, any questions or comments, anything that I didn't make quite clear? Okay, either put you guys to sleep or I explained it really well. Del.
I was wondering, when you're doing a fill-in translator for an AM, mm-hmm. I realize it's the daytime coverage. It has to be within the 2 millivolt daytime coverage of that AM. How does that apply? I recently talked to somebody who had an AM pattern that was actually tighter in the day than it was at night.
Yeah.
Is it major lobe, or do you have to keep that signal out of where the nulls would be normally?
If I understand correctly, the 60 dBU contour off the translator must reside entirely within that 2 millivolt contour, okay? And also that 25-mile radius. The corollary to that, by the way, is that a translator for an AM is by definition considered a fill-in translator, just because of that. It's just filled in differently. Now, you don't necessarily have to locate that translator at the AM site. So if you've got a four-tower parallelogram where you've got a fairly broad lobe going one particular direction and it's real tight off the back, yeah, you could stick it out in the middle of that lobe, okay, something like that. So there's no limitation on the translator having to be located at the AM site. It's just the AM site is used as the reference point for that 25-mile circus, that's probably appropriate. And then, of course, you know, the 2 millivolt contour. I think it uses M3, and most of the stuff we're going to do based on M3, but if you had measured conductivity that was a lot greater, I don't see why you couldn't use that as well, because measured is always acceptable. So that may be, you know, another way around it, is if you know that your connectivity is much greater than what the map shows, submit that. Who is that? I can't see who it is.
Hi, Dan Ryson.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
Great.
One of my colleagues.
You outlined the protections that were required for the translators that were filed in 2003, that we have to protect low-power FM stations that might be applied for throughout that grid. What do you anticipate will happen to those protection areas after this filing window is open if people hadn't actually applied for LPFMs at those grid locations?
Yeah, excellent question. I'm going to back up real quick and add to this because there's another part of this that I did mention that I should have. One of the things that came out in the reports and order on the LPFM that a lot of people didn't pick up on, and I glossed over it when I read it, I don't know if you guys did too, Dan, was that it talked about any application filed after the public notice announcing the opening of the LPFM window was not protected, okay? And so what we see on a lot of these construction permits that have come out, and especially ones that have been modified, it's kind of a beware type of thing, and there is specifically a condition on there that says you're going to have to protect the grid through the close of the window. Now, what I interpret that, and you guys probably interpret the same way, is if nobody files on it, that grid just goes away. And that's kind of the end of it, because... Now, we have to sort of be careful on that, because there is a provision that may allow some of the LPFMs, if they get into an MX situation, to amend their applications to jump to a different channel. So. Before we start doing that, we're going to have to wait till the dust settles big time, I think. You agree with that? Okay, cool.
Just back to the question about between nighttime and daytime pattern for AM. Mm-hmm. So even if you have a drastic change in your pattern or power, like I have a station that runs 3,000 some watts during the day and then drops to 273 at night. So as long as I'm inside that 2 millivolt contour, my daytime 2 millivolt convert, I can put that translator wherever I want.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Because remember, the idea with the fill-in translators was to help a lot of the AM stations that had coverage issues at night, and whether that be low power, if you were a Class D where you had a secondary authorization, or even if you had a very, very high interference free level. There's no restriction on the night. The night doesn't even enter into it. It's based solely on the day. And the other thing is, even if you have to shut down at night, you can still operate the translator at night, even if the AM has to go off. Dale? I think that's Dale, isn't it? Okay, go ahead. No, go ahead, Dale. What do you got?
In relation to the AM using an FM translator, can you do similarly like you've been doing with FM? Can you go HD on AM? Can you pick up two FM translators in it?
I don't see that. I don't think we're not running multiple streams in the AM. That's, you know, with the FMs, that's basically a way to get a secondary stream or a tertiary stream out there because the receiver density is not there.
If they allow that with FM, why not AM? If you go HD.
Well, there isn't a secondary or tertiary stream with the AM. So, I mean, you could do it, but, I mean, even though it's HD, it's just basically, you know, digital AM, so there's the one program stream there. All right, thanks, Chuck. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.